Hello and welcome to the 14th episode of Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality, The Sultanate of Women. In the previous videos covering the Ottomans, we have covered the rise of the Ottomans and their Golden Age, or Classical Age, during which the Ottomans were able to conquer the Balkans and establish their seat of power in the Eastern Roman capital of Constantinople, reach Vienna in 1529 in the north, Algeria in the west, Eritrea and Yemen in the south, and Iraq and the Caucasus in the east. These great campaigns were often led by great warrior sultans, Ghazis, meaning warriors of the faith, the most notable being Murad, who was slain at the Battle of Kosovo, Mehmed II, the conqueror, who took the city of Constantinople from the Byzantines, Selim the Grim, who conquered the Caliphate and took over control of the Levant and Egypt, and of course Suleiman the Magnificent, under which the Ottoman Empire reaches its apex. Nevertheless, while we see the apex of Ottoman expansionism under Suleiman the Magnificent, we also see the first major checks to it, as were illustrated in depth in his previous episodes. To counteract that, we see the rise of the so-called Sultanate of Women, and this is often typically started with the idea of Suleiman the Magnificent marrying Roxolana, Hürrem Sultan, who exercised a considerable influence over the Sultan, resulting in the deaths of various competent officials such as Grand Izier Ibrahim Pasha, and of course the potentially competent heir in the mould of his father Mustafa, in a manner very similar to Constantine and Crispus. Suleiman was in turn succeeded by his rather unexceptional son by Roxolana, Selim II. While Ottoman power would remain formidable for the next century, the age of the great campaigning sultan was drawing to a close. Too often the period after the death of Suleiman the Magnificent is considered a period of decline, and for reference during this lecture I'm going to be using the term 17th century, not to strictly refer to the 17th century, but rather the period from 1566 until 1683. So if we're not going to consider this a period of decline necessarily, perhaps relative decline, the idea of Ottoman decline will no doubt inform many of our questions surrounding this period, but it is not the central question I want to answer for today's chronicle of the Ottomans in this definition of the 17th century. Instead, I want to understand the transformation of the Sultanate, that being the Sultans beginning this period as proactive and martial to becoming relatively passive and fulfilling a ceremonial role. I have titled this episode A Sultanate of Women. I don't mean that in the sense that there were female sultans, although there were formidable figures during this period, such as the grand dowager queen, Khurshem. Nor do I mean that strictly in the sense that the sultans were all dominated by women, though that is certainly an angle which is going to pervade this lecture. I mean this idea to be all-encompassing for the nature of how power was wielded or perhaps effeminized in the Ottoman Empire during the 17th century, a process that went beyond the concubines and wives Haseki Sultan and the mothers Valide Sultan, to encompass the Ottoman right of succession and the centrality of the imperial harem as an institution beyond individual female actors. Now I've completed the introduction, I do want to say that if anyone has a question, please do ask me when this lecture is over. It should be about an hour. Now, to begin, I have this rather wonderful excerpt from Leslie P. Pierce, the Imperial Harem, Women and Sovereignty in the Ottoman Empire. And I've given the citation for this book, which you can access down in the description. The harem, sacred, protected, forbidden. To an Ottoman subject, the term harem did not connote a space defined exclusively by sexuality. The word harem is one of an important family of words in the vocabulary of Islam, derived from the Arabic root harem. These words partake of one or both of two generally and obviously related meanings associated with the root to be forbidden or unlawful and to declare sacred, inviolable, or taboo. A harem is by definition a sanctuary or a sacred precinct. By implication, it is a space to which general access is forbidden or controlled, and in which the presence of certain individuals or certain modes of behaviour are forbidden. That the private quarters in a domestic residence, and by extension its female residence, are referred to as harem comes from the Islamic practice of restricting access to these quarters, specifically access by males beyond a particular degree of consanguinity with the resident females. The word harem is a term of respect, redolent of religious purity and honour, and evocative of the requisite obeisance. It is gender-specific only in it is a reference to the women of a family. The most sacred or exalted places in the 16th century Ottoman world were harems. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina and their environs were, and remain, the two most revered harems in Islam. One of the most important titles held after 1517 by the Ottoman Sultan, like the sultans of the preceding dynasties before him, the servant of the two holy sanctuaries, Hadum ad Harimin ul Serifin, a title proudly used today by the rulers of Saudi Arabia. The central Muslim religious compound in Jerusalem, Islam's third most holy city, was also known as the noble sanctuary, Harem el Serif. In Ottoman usage, the inner courtyard of a mosque, its sanctuary, was also a harem. While not himself divine, the Sultan, God's shadow on earth, created a sacred space with his presence. Because the Sultan lived there, the inner precinct of the royal palace, inhabited only by males, was known as the imperial harem. When, toward the end of the 16th century, the Sultan established a second set of private quarters in the palace precinct to house women and children of the royal household, the latter area also began to be referred to as the imperial harem, because of the presence there, not of women, but of the Sultan. The inviolability of the imperial residence in the minds of the Sultan's subjects is revealed by the fact it was not well defined, and yet was rarely assaulted, even in the 17th century, when sultans themselves began to be forcefully deposed and even murdered. It was not in one of the great public mosques of the city, but rather in the inner precinct of the palace, that the holiest relics of Islam were enshrined when brought to Istanbul after the conquest in 1517 of the Mamluk Sultanate. In times of crisis, the Sultan manipulated these relics, especially the mantle and sacred standard of the Prophet Muhammad, to create a public aura of harem-like sanctuary so that he might invoke the supernormal standards of loyalty from his subjects. Ottoman society of the 16th and 17th centuries was dichotomized into spheres characterized less by notions of public, commonweal, male, private, domestic, female, than by distinctions between the privileged and the common, the sacred and the profane, distinctions that cut across the dichotomy of gender. We can perhaps better perceive the ill fit of a public male private female dichotomy if we examine the language that Ottomans themselves used to describe divisions in their society. From centuries of Muslims before them, the Ottomans inherited the terms has and am. The stock phrase, the has and the am, have both the abstract level of meaning, the private, particular, or singular, versus the universal, and a socio-political meaning, the elite versus the common, the ruling class versus the ruled. The word has, however, presumably aroused a more complex range of associations because of its additional meaning, of that which is associated with or belongs to the ruler, that is, anything royal. Many of the institutional manifestations of royal power were denoted by the word has. For example, the Sultan's privy chamber has has oda, privileged attendants to the Sultan, male and female, who bore the title haseki, and the royal domains known simply as has. In the 17th century, Ottoman usage of the word has appears to have the additional meaning of sanctity. More prevalent in the Ottoman self-description is the dichotomy of inner and outer, the interior and the exterior. Two sets of words, one Turkish and one Persian, were commonly used to describe this division. İçlişeri in Turkish and Enderun in Persian, for the inner or interior, and correspondingly, dişi dışarı or tasra or birun, for the outer or exterior. Bernard Lewis has pointed out the division that power relationships in Islamic society are represented by spatial division, more horizontal than vertical. In contrast to Western metaphors, instead of moving up, one moves in toward greater authority. The provinces of the empire were referred to as Tasra, that which lay outside Constantinople, the charismatic centre. In government, Ish or Isheri referred to whenever the Sultan was and to wherever that belonged to him personally, for example, his personal treasury or the pages who served under him in his private quarters. In this usage, Ish is very similar to Has in simply meaning royal, but though its opposition to its complement, the outer administration, the emphasis could be seen to be slightly different, the purely sultanic or dynastic element in government, the inner household of the Sultan. The overlap among the concepts of harem, has, and isheri is not difficult to see. Each is defined by eligibility and exclusion. Each represents status and honour. As one ascends the socio-political scale, to revert to a Western metaphor, authority is increasingly a phenomena of the inner, often literally an interior, even residential space, the boundaries of which are guarded. This is an inversion of the dominant modern Western notions of the politically significant as outer or public, and the politically marginal as inner or private and domestic. Harem, Has, and Isheri converge to place the sultan and the space he inhabits at the apex, or in an Ottoman idiom, the vortex, of the social, moral, and political order. The symbolism of the inner as order and security, and the vital function of the ruler in bringing about this order, has been demonstrated by Walter Andrews in his study of the meaning and syntax of Ottoman poetry of this period in its relation to Ottoman society, broadly considered. The importance of spatial boundaries in delimiting moral and political spheres in the Ottoman conception of property, ordered society is revealed in a passage in the mid-17th century history of Mehmed Halif. In the 1620s, a period of political turmoil when life in the capital was frequently disrupted by the dissatisfied and undisciplined troops stationed there, it seemed to Mehmed Halif that the world had lost all order and coherence. He cited a long list of crimes perpetrated by the troops, dragging women naked from public baths, smoking in the mosque of Mehmed the Conqueror, committing rape and sodomy openly on the streets, invading homes and palaces, and inviting the Sultan and the Queen Mother to join street corners, celebrations of religious festivals. Each of these outrages caused the inversion of the inner and the outer and violated a social, religious, or political boundary. Whether these crimes all actually occurred is not important. What is significant is that Mehmed Halif was making his point about the political weakness and social chaos of the times in the most striking possible terms. And this isn't, again, all just metaphor. In this particular instance, he's referring particularly to the case around the 1620s until the 1650s, where the Janissaries played a far more active political role. In this case, in 1622, we see the assassination by the Janissaries of the Sultan Osman II. So this admonition against the Janissaries, I think, is well deserved. Indeed, the idea of degeneracy and debauchery, which very much played into the political manifesto of Murad the Fourth. The inner as the source of power. Of all Ottomans, the Sultan naturally strove to surround himself with the most impenetrable barriers to his presence. Wherever he was on the battlefield, in the inner palace, the space he occupied was visibly set off by physical or human boundaries. Even in the mosque, the most intrinsically egalitarian space in Muslim society, where the Sultan was theoretically no greater than any of his subjects, he occupied a structurally isolated area. This insistence on the public display of splendid isolation was an aspect of ancient Near Eastern imperial traditions. The Ottomans were heir to these traditions through two channels: Islamic monarchy, as elaborated by the various caliphates, sultanates and principates of the Muslim past, and Christian Byzantine monarchy, itself heir to the imperial traditions of both the Roman Empire and the empires of the ancient and Near East. So in this case, we'll probably be talking about the Neo-Assyrians and the Hittites and the Babylonians, and of course the Persians, the Achaemenids. The centuries-long contact of Anatolian Turks with Byzantine civilization, culminating in the conquest of the Byzantine capital of Constantinople in 1453, had an undeniable influence on Ottoman civilization, perhaps particularly on its imperial institutions. In Ottoman historical legend, however, imperial traditions were acquired from fellow Muslim rulers. Supposedly, it was when told by a prince of a rival dynasty that it was not fitting for rulers to live in the midst of the masses that the Sultan Mehmed II, the conqueror, moved from the palace he had built in the centre of the newly conquered city to a new palace constructed on a more inaccessible site, the Topkapi Palace. It is noteworthy, however, that the second palace, known today as the Topkapi Palace, was built on the site of the ancient Byzantine Acropolis, and that the Ottoman sultans kept the neighbouring Byzantine Hippodrome as the principal arena of their public ceremonies, and the adjacent Basilica of Hagia Sophia as their premier imperial mosque. The structure of the imperial palace communicated both the identity of the sovereign's residence as the central political arena of the empire and the difficulty of obtaining access to the sovereign within that arena. When understood in the context of multiple resonances of the inner, this was not the paradox it might seem. One consequence of the sovereign's remoteness was that the potential for enormous power lay in the hands of those who were intermediaries, formal and informal, between the Sultan and those who governed in his name on the outside. The first courtyard of the imperial palace was open to the public. The second courtyard was a semi-public theatre of government, where foreign ambassadors were received with elaborate ceremony, and where the imperial council sat, presided over by the Grand Vizier, and on occasion secretly observed by the Sultan from a concealed cubicle. While access to this courtyard was generally limited to members of the governing elite, ordinary subjects with petitions for the Sultan's justice might enter. The third and innermost courtyard was the imperial harem, Harem im Humayun, known also as the Enderun I Humayun, the imperial interior. Here lived hundreds of carefully selected boys and young men who had been trained for government service, their white eunuch guards and preceptors, and until the end of the 16th century, the Sultan himself. The third courtyard was accessible to virtually no one from the outside, and its inhabitants were denied passage to the outside world except when accompanying the Sultan. Only the Sultan could freely cross the boundary, isolating the inner courtyard, but when he did, he was surrounded by its eunuchs and youths of the interior, the imperial harem transported with him. It is well known that in the system of personal rule, that is, absolute monarchy, proximity to the ruler is an index of power. Conversely, a principal expression of an absolute monarch's power is the control of access to his person. Manipulating political hierarchies and royal protocol was perhaps the principal means by which the Ottoman Sultan both projected and protected his power. With the exception of the Sultan, only those who were not considered to be fully adult males were routinely permitted in the inner worlds of the palace, in the male harem household, boys and young men, eunuchs, dwarves and mutes, and in the family harem household, women and children. Even men in the palace who were fully adult under Islamic law, the most advanced pages in training, and some princes of the dynasty were kept in a state of symbolic adolescent dependence, for they were forbidden to grow beards or to father children. And this, of course, is something I'll get into later, the gilded cage idea, the kef. The highest officials of the empire, the Grand Vizier, and the leaders of the religious hierarchy, the Mufti, also known as the Sheikh al-Islam, might meet personally with the Sultan, but only with his permission, and in well-guarded areas, just inside the gate separating the inner third courtyard from the semi-public second courtyard. On the rare occasion when the Sultan desired or was forced to meet with members of the outer government, ordinary subjects, the audience was held outside this gate. Routine communication between the outside world and the inner palace was handled by the eunuch corps and guarded the two harems, white eunuchs for the male harem and black eunuchs for the female. And this was a particular practice which was brought in by the Sultan Murad III, bringing in black Muslim slaves, often from the east coast of Africa, Tanzania, etc. The importance of these liminal figures in mediating the boundaries, both physical and moral, established harems, has been demonstrated by Marmon in the context of Mamluk society. One's status was marked by the extent to which one could penetrate the interior of another's household, most of all that of the Sultan. A dramatic example of the desirability of proximity to the ultimate source of power is that of Ghazanfar Agha, who himself was castrated so that he may remain close to the Sultan, his patron. Ghazanfar was a Hungarian renegade who converted to Islam and assimilated into the Ottoman ruling class, had risen high in the service of Prince Selim, son of Suleiman the Magnificent. When Selim ascended the throne in 1566, he invited Ghazanfar, his brother Jafar, to join his inner household, which they could only do as eunuchs. Jafar did not survive the operation, but Ghazanfar went on to hold two of the most important offices of the inner service, chief white eunuch and head of the privy chamber. He was one of the most influential persons in government for a period of more than 30 years, spanning the reigns of Selim, his son, and his grandson, a tenure longer than that of any Grand Vizier. And as we go over the chronology of this period, you're going to see that in any palace intrigue, the support of both the white chief eunuch and the black chief eunuch was considered essential for any palace coup. The more intimate one's service to the Sultan in the inner world, the greater was one's standing in the outer world. Those male pages of the third courtyard, who held highest ranks of the privy chamber, were, upon graduation from the inner palace, destined to hold the highest military administrative offices in the empire. While eunuchs could also emerge to hold high office, indeed there were several eunuch grand viziers in the early modern period, when toward the end of the 16th century, the Sultan established private quarters in the women's precinct, its highest ranking members became the subjects closest to the empire centre of power. This new harem quickly became, in addition to the residence of the royal family, a highly structured and disciplined training institution in which female members of the royal household were prepared through personal service to the Sultan and his mother to take their places in the Ottoman ruling elite, much like the pages trained in the third courtyard. Like the pages, most would leave the harem after a term of service, and in fact marriages were frequently arranged between products of the two imperial harems. Only a few women would remain prominent members of the dynastic household, the talented and lucky few who became the Sultan's concubines or promoted to senior administrative positions. Although they rarely crossed the harem boundary to the outside world, these high-ranking women enjoyed considerable prestige and exercised considerable influence in the world. Often these women who were groomed, essentially, to be the consorts of the Sultan or serve in his administration through the apparatus of the harem had an education befitting that of a monarch. So, for example, Khushem Sultan had an understanding of not only the political workings of the harem, but of mathematics, philosophy, history, and of course, theology. So this was a training area for power in the purest sense, and it was given to the women of the court. You were expected to be not only beautiful, but exceptionally intelligent to hold the rank of Hesseki Sultan, and if you were lucky, to be the Valide Sultan, the queen mother, having born a child with a sultan, and that child having become the sultan. The results of such a system of impenetrability and isolation reached their height, and when I mean height, I mean that in the sense of prestige, under the absolutism of Suleiman the Magnificent, who nevertheless continued to campaign in person and died on campaign towards Vienna. So here I'm going to go into the particular sultans themselves and how this idea of the mechanism of the imperial harem and how power was actually functioning affects the broader narrative. In fact, the presence of the Sultan was seen as essential to conducting a major campaign a la the Roman emperors. Often you see in the crisis of the third century, the crisis revolves around the loyalty of the troops originally proclaiming emperors, and the emperor, the Caesar, needs to be everywhere at the same time. Hence you have the creation of a system of a tetrarchy established by Diocletian to create colleagues for the various emperors. And of course, Constantine made a huge sort of step in this direction by setting up the capital in Constantinople, which had quick access or relatively quick access to the borders against Iran and the borders against Hungary, which of course was exploited when the Ottomans took over and used Constantinople as their seat of power. From 1566 to 74, so now Suleiman the Magnificent has finally died on campaign, Selim II comes to the throne. And again, it's important to note in terms of the succession that his reign is essentially the result of his mother's contrivance. He wasn't intended to be ruler. Mustafa was intended to be ruler. Mustafa was more confident. But of course, in becoming the formal wife of Suleiman the Magnificent, Hesseki Sultan, I think it's fair to say that Hürrem Sultan contrived the death of her rival for her son, Mustafa, allowing him to come to the throne. But of course, this inaugurates a period of typically weak sultans, with a few exceptions, which I'll go into. And in terms of the weakness and presaging this all about this idea of decline, in 1571, we of course have the defeat at Lepanto, referring this to the end of the previous lecture. However, at the same time, in terms of mentioning this as strict decline or stagnation or whatever, the defeat at Lepanto for the Ottomans is compensated to some extent by their conquest of Cyprus. So it's never quite that simple. And the Ottoman Empire will continue to gain territories on and off and lose them throughout this entire period, which is the source of this lecture. Selim was renowned for his isolation, and while he was considered a compassionate monarch, opening the palace stores of food to the public during a famine in 1574, he spent his time in the palace, even abandoning the aforementioned practice of attending the Friday prayer, albeit in seclusion in public. The female influence of Selim came from his sister Miramar and his wife Nurbanu. I'll just move the slide here. Milamar had been a formidable presence during the later reign of her father, as the wife of a grand vizier. In particular, she was exceptionally wealthy, and even lent the Sultan money on occasion. During the reign of both her brother and her nephew, Murad III, she often directly communicated with foreign ambassadors, such as that of Henry III of France. Nobano continued in the vein of Roxolana, becoming the wife, rather than the mere concubine, of Mehmed III, and like Miramar, influencing foreign policy during her time as, Selim II, during her time as Hesekhi, through her influence, albeit indirect, and according to the Venetians, she exerted both influence over her husband, Selim II, and over the Grand Vizier, Sekulu. So essentially, we also see this period where the Sultan is becoming remote from the day-to-day affairs of government, albeit sometimes he'll sit in this this separate cubicle, separating the government spheres of power from the imperial household. So all executive power as a result of this, when you have a disinterested sultan, is being wielded nominally by the Grand Vizier, who often is in contact with the various beys and governorships, such as that of Egypt. And in this particular instance, coming back to the influence of women, the Hesekhi Sultan, Nobano, had to have influence essentially not only over the Sultan, but over the Grand Vizier as her agent. In this case, it was a man called Sekulu. It had previously the custom to send all the Ottoman princes to become governors of the provinces to raise their prestige and competence in preparation for the succession. Both Selim II and Suleiman's ascensions were uncontested. Selim had made it clear that he meant to establish a system of primogeniture for Murad III, his first son by Nurbanu. This failed to prevent the system of fratricide, and of course, linking this back, when you have, after essentially Orhan, you have these fratricidal brotherly civil wars, which are expected as part of the Ottoman system, and the winner of that conflict has to defeat or execute all of his other brothers in order to establish his legitimacy. Such things, such as primogeniture, were not ever established in the Ottoman Empire, and often when talking about the power of the court in the early stages, the idea essentially was that your mother was your political advocate from within the system, constantly maneuvering on the behalf of the respective heir. And as we saw with Suleiman the Magnificent, this was often a bloody affair, as was the case with Mustafa and Hulem Sultan advocating for her son Selim. This failed to prevent the system of fratricide, this move towards primogeniture, for Murad III. And Murad had his five younger brothers ritually strangled. Murad III paradoxically brought the empire to its greatest territorial extent with the conclusion of the successful Ottoman-Safavid War from 1578 to 1590, while never having gone on campaign, nor leaving Constantinople, nor would he leave the Topkapi Palace in the final years of his reign. Ottoman scholars contemporary to Murad, Mustafa Ali and Solanki, decried the generation of the Sultan as a martial leader, instead prone to isolation and debauchery. Completely under the influence of the women of the court, Sekulu retained his position during the early reign through the influence of his wife, Murad's sister, Ismahin Sultan. The real power in the harem and over the Sultan was contested by Nurbanu and Murad's wife, Safiye, again following the practice established by Suleiman of monogamy, although this time Nurbanu attempted to outflank Safiye by encouraging Murad to have as many concubines and thus heirs as possible, even accusing Safiye of witchcraft to undermine her influence over the Sultan. This intervention by Nurbanu against Safiye indirectly led to one of the bloodiest acts in the history of the Ottoman court. The intervention had been entirely ineffective in ending Safiye's influence over the palace, as her son would succeed as Mehmed III. Upon his ascension, the fratricidal nature of Ottoman succession reached a peak when 19 of the Sultan's brothers, some deaf, dumb, essentially influenced, you know, never considered a possible political threat, were ritually strangled. Moreover, Mehmed III was just as kept as his predecessors, with Safiye Sultan exercising even greater influence through various puppet viziers. That said, Mehmed III was the first sultan in 30 years to lead a campaign, the successful victory at Xerxes against the Habsburgs, though the effort nearly killed him, as the sultan was described as being a drunkard and possibly obese. One possible break to the end of the stranglehold of women, in particular Safiye, on the empire, came from Mehmed's son Mahmud. For the first time since the reign of Selim, there were major riots in Anatolia, the Kalali rebellions, caused by an increase in levies and taxation during the War of Persia. led by the Sekbans, or Irregulars. The rebellions were centered around Sivas, and again, people who remember the previous lecture understand that this region around Sivas and the Dolgadir region had been a source of religious anxiety for Selim the Grim, in particular because it was a Shia region, one of the few Shia regions in Anatolia. And this region was there were various pogroms committed by Selim against this region to reduce the Shia population by force. So it's interesting that when we see the rise of the Anatolian Irregulars, and these Kelali rebellions are going to persist throughout most of the 17th century, these particular rebellions on and off over the next sort of 50 years, it happens to be around this region of Sivas and Dolgadir in the east. Despite the victory at Kadazetsis, the long Turkish war against the Habsburgs, and again, when I mean the Habsburgs, I'm talking about the Austrians, who also control Bohemia, Hungary, their various allies within the Holy Roman Empire and Spain, was proven costly and indecisive. Rumours of a conspiracy abounded around the young Prince Mahmud, who was to be made Sultan, while his father would be poisoned. While no evidence could be found of this conspiracy, Mahmud's mother Halime was censured and Mahmud was executed to satisfy the Sultan, even though no evidence could be found against him. In reality, Safiya had removed a potential rival in Halime. Mehmed III soon died after, and now a child, Ahmed, was Sultan, and this was an unprecedented situation for the Ottomans. But before getting on to the reign of Ahmed, I want to turn briefly to the Janissaries. The Janissaries were a distinctive military corps in a number of ways. They wore unique uniforms, were paid regular salaries, and were often given bonuses directly by the Sultan, who one of the first things a Sultan would do would be to enter the barracks dressed as a Janissary trooper and increase their pay, again, presaging any sort of Praetorian-esque elements to them. But they were in many respects a sort of proto-professional army in the fact that they had, I believe, the first ever military brand, the Mater. And of course, the Materan is probably the easiest expressions of sort of Ottoman music during this time, military music, which, you know, accompanied all of the various campaigns led by the Sultan, because the Janissaries were a vanguard on the Sultan's campaigns. They also served as policemen, palace guards, household guards in particular, and firefighters throughout Constantinople. And the Janissaries enjoyed far better support and both material and, of course, leadership from the Sultan on campaign than any other armies at the time. They were part of a well-organized military machine in which one support prepared the road, and which one support corps prepared the roads while they pitched tents. And of course, you even have full-time Janissary bakers as well working in the palace. And I believe they continue until the imperial administration moves out of the Topkapi Palace in the 19th century. Their weapons and ammunition were transported and resupplied by their own dedicated corps, and they campaigned with their own medical team. And again, many Jewish surgeons in particular assisted the Janissary Corps. So what we see in the Janissaries is, again, the nucleus of what you consider a modern army, with all the amenities, logistics corps, supply corps, transportation, modern transportation for weapons and ammunitions, and even mobile hospitals at the same time. Nevertheless, this relationship, again, they're supposed to be dedicated to the Sultan, was never always happy. Even before the decline of the Janissaries, which I'm about to go over, there was this attempt in 1449 to extort Mehmed II. You know, right from the beginning of the reign of Mehmed II, the Janissaries demanded that their pay be increased. And of course, this was it came up again in 1451, and therefore the assumption thereafter, even though the Janissaries knew essentially no loyalty other than to the Sultan, was the first act of a new Sultan, whether it be Bayezid, whether it be Selim the Grim, was to increase the funding for the Janissaries. In this case, they are quite similar to the Varangians, bringing this into continuity with the Byzantine history, in the sense that once the Varangians were paid by a new emperor, they were ferociously loyal. And of course, one of the things surrounding the sack of Constantinople in 1204 is the fact that there is such a contest of legitimacy and so many new emperors that the Varangians do not play an active role in defending the city when it comes to the actual sack. The crux of the Janissary loyalty hinged on the Devachurni. And again, the Devachurni, essentially the Christian levy employed on the conquered areas, because you could not enslave a Muslim. The idea essentially was that when they were going forth into Bulgaria and Greece, etc., and Macedonia, the Ottomans were acquiring this in order to draw slave levies into the army. And indeed, these were not slaves which were just owned, you know, by the state. These were the personal slaves of the Sultan, and they knowed no other allegiance than as slaves of the Sultan. And what is fascinating about the Janissaries is that they began their life as sort of semi-monastic order. There was this expectation of celibacy in the early Janissaries. It wasn't until much later, when you had moved outside of the militarily appropriate age in the areas of which most Janissaries became officials in their 40s, when the Janissaries were some finally allowed to have children. But for the most part, celibacy was a core aspect of the early Janissaries. And because of this, the Janissaries were essentially considered a fraternal society, a semi-monastic fraternal society in defense of their Sultan, who was their adoptive father. And in terms of adding to the religiosity of the Janissaries, Sufism exerted a great influence over the Janissary corps through their adoption of the Bektashi order after their dervish saint founder, Haji Bektash, who was an interesting Muslim figure around, I believe, the region of Khorasan in eastern Iran in the early 13th century. In addition to their status as elite vanguard for the Sultan, after the Persian Wars, Janissaries became garrison troops, in addition to merely siege warfare experts. And what I mean by that is that often it will be the Janissaries who were first into the breach whenever there was a break in the walls, as with the Siege of Constantinople. Ostensibly, this was because of the expansionism of the empire, but really the aim of the Janissaries had begun to transition from the expansionism of the empire to maintenance and consolidation. So we've gone over in previous lectures the classical age of the Ottoman Empire, the rapid growth of the Ottoman Empire. But now, as the Ottoman Empire is rededicating its efforts towards defense, towards the late reign of Suleiman the Magnificent, after it appears after 1529 in particular, and the Safavid Wars, that the Ottomans are not going to be engaging on any rapid conquests anytime soon, that we see a massive expansion of the Janissary Corps. To put this in perspective, the original Janissaries around the beginning of this time period, so we're talking around the year 1500, 1520, the beginning of the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Devachurni were almost entirely made up of Greeks, Albanians, etc., other slave peoples, slave Christians from the Balkans, and their number was kept to an elite guard. Originally it was 1,000 men, but it was expanded to 10,000 men by the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent. And after this rapid expansion, by around the time of the reign of the Sultan Ahmed, there were around 40,000 men. So this elite corps was becoming much larger in its scope. And again, I believe this transition from the Sultan's vanguard on campaign to becoming a peacetime force of maintaining the empire is crucial to understanding this this slackening of the system. But also the increased demand of levies also meant the end of the Devachurni system. Their ranks now became open to free Muslims and members of the regular army. And often these were selected by various Janissary commanders. So people weren't selected on the basis of their military competence, but on the basis of their loyalty to particular heads of the Janissaries at that time. Even civilians could bribe their way in for the associated privileges and the proximity to the Sultan. So what we're seeing here is the slackening of standards and the beginning of the degeneracy of the system. And to couple this and what the implications are for the loyalty to the Sultan in particular, Selim II, so at the beginning of this period, permitted the Janissaries to marry and for the children to enter the order. Now, and of course, combine this with the abolition of celibacy. One of the reasons the Janissaries have been so successful for the Sultan is the fact that this was an army without associated lands. You didn't need to appease them. Yes, they were awarded loot often a privileged aspect of Luton. They were expected to be paid. But if you didn't give them land and they didn't have children and you weren't establishing dynasties within the Janissary order, it essentially meant that you were still the Sultan, still rely on their loyalty because they didn't have a constituency they could rely on other than the Sultan himself. But now we're seeing with the garrisoning of various fortresses outside of Constantinople, beyond the direct remit of the Sultan, the Janissaries were now establishing effective fiefs. Acquisitions in Anatolia in particular, I believe, were a major cause for the Sekban rebellions in eastern Anatolia. So the Janissaries were becoming everything they were not supposed to be by the year 1600. So the relationship between Sultan and the Janissaries are fundamentally changed by 1600. And for the Devachani system in particular to begin to collapse, the distinction of the Janissaries being slaves to the Ottoman Sultan was again blurred. They had ceased to become direct slaves of the Sultan, and now they were becoming a political body with its own interests. So now gone were the particular bonds that tie the Janissaries to the Sultan, while they were receiving privileges and salaries above regular soldiers, including that proximity to the Sultan. There was really little to differentiate themselves from regular troops, other than their particular uniforms. And again, a part of Ottoman society in general is the exercise of sumptuary laws indicating status. But rather than just writing off the Janissaries in particular, you know, completely throughout this period, at the beginnings of the year 1600, the Janissaries were still interesting in the fact that they were still considered a professional outfit, and they were innovating in military tactics, such as the use of volley fire from musket warfare from this time. But as we progress throughout the 17th century, the Janissaries become more decadent, more reactionary, and their military edge has become completely eclipsed by the year 1700. And this laxing of the professionalism of the Janissaries as a military corps really sort of accelerates when the Janissaries are able to engage in trades other than the military trade or government or being essentially government officials. So by the 18th century, the Janissaries have become entirely hostile to military innovations, and they attacked anything that threatened their particular status. And by the reign of Ahmed, their status as a household guard was considered in part a hindrance, not an asset, as the Sultan had become, for all intents and purposes, in terms of the Sultan's guard, the Janissaries had essentially become the Ottoman version of a late Praetorian guard. Now, returning to Safiya Sultan and Sultan Ahmed, of course, Safiya Sultan is the woman behind the throne, now the grandmother of Sultan Ahmed, and this transitioning between, you know, one rule of one woman and the rule of the next. The fact that now this is Sultan Ahmed, I believe he was 13 when he became Sultan, the fact that a minor was now the Sultan under the influence of his grandmother, Safiya, was an unprecedented situation for the House of Osman. As Ahmed had not demonstrated his sexual virility, engaging in fratricide could have ended the House of Osman, as Mustafa, Ahmed's brother, was considered the only boy capable of continuing the dynasty. For now, at least, this expectation was still that the Sultan should reach an appropriate age to sire children. But this was the first time that a Sultan's brother was seriously considered a legitimate successor, rather than the usurper. The new Sultan was unable to exploit the disunity in the empire, owing to the brothers' quarrel in the Austrian Empire, of course, and the various prelude to the 30 Years' War. So really, I think when looking at this in the context of sort of Austrian history and the 30 Years' War, it was quite possible, had Ahmed been a capable, powerful Sultan, that the Ottomans could have renewed their attack on Europe during the first half of the 17th century. But as we go into the intricacies of this period, you understand that the volatile nature of the political court and the incapacity of most of the sultans would render that impossible. At the time that we're seeing the decline of the Ottoman court, the Safavids have a new capable leader in the form of Shah Abbas, who by now had recovered all of the Ottomans' territorial conquests over the previous 60 years. And just for people who are interested in Iranian Safavid history, Shah Abbas was responsible for moving the capital from Tabriz in Iranian Azerbaijan to the city of Esfahan, meaning half the world, and which is, of course, considered the pinnacle of early sort of 17th century Safavid architecture. The reign of Ahmed in particular is also known, a brief note, but this will become important in later lectures, for expanding the Ottoman system of capitulations. The Turkish capitulations were grants made by successive sultans to Christian nations, conferring rights and privileges in favour of their subjects resident or trading in the Ottoman dominions, following the policy towards European states by the Byzantine Empire. And of course, this goes all the way back to the Venetians and essentially the Angloid dynasty outsourcing a navy to the Venetians and allowing the Venetians certain trading privileges. And of course, when we look at Emperor Andronikos in the late 12th century, this one of the things he does is massacre the Genoese and Venetian denizens in the city. So this idea of the capitulations, special trade privileges to Westerners, is nothing new. Really, the Ottomans don't innovate in this way. They are simply inheriting a system left to them by the Byzantines. And as I mentioned in the previous lecture, what the Ottomans were very cautious to do when they conquered Constantinople was keep the diplomatic networks of the capitulations, in particular with the Republic of Venice, going, so there was as little disruption to profit and trade as possible. According to the capitulations, traders entering the Ottoman Empire were exempt from local prosecution, local taxation, local conscription, and various other forms. And again, this is, you can say, an early form of extraterritoriality. The capitulations initially made during the Ottoman Empire's military dominance, and this, of course, was a means to entice and encourage commercial exchange with Western merchants. However, after military dominance began to shift to Europe during this period, the economic and political advantages granted by the Ottomans to European powers began to act as a detriment. Often it has been considered that the Ottomans had extreme free trade going into the 18th century that essentially resulted in the rape of their economy. In opposition to the mercantilism which was being pursued by the Bourbons in Spain and France. Under Ahmed, capitulations were afforded to Venice, France, England and Netherlands. And just mentioning England, because this ties in nicely with the previous lecture on Russia, England in particular had been trading with the Ottomans intensively and forming a interesting diplomatic correspondence under the reign of Elizabeth I. And if you look at it geostrategically, it made sense for the Protestant Elizabeth I to come closer in terms of trade and military cooperation with the Sultan, as indeed she did with Ivan the Terrible and the Danilovich dynasty, and later the Romanovs, again allying with heathen powers, and in the case of the Russians, an Orthodox power against Habsburg Spanish Catholic rivals. Much of this policy hadn't, up until about 1604, been directed by Safir. And if you look at the influence of women in particular, the women of the court, Nohano, Safir, later Kushem, very much pursued this, you could say, pro-Western line in terms of keeping these peace negotiations, these trade capitulations alive. One of the first major exploits of Ahmed, however, was to finally banish Safir from the imperial harem, and again, just give her a major stipend as a commiseration prize. But this did not represent a return of the Sultan's authority, rather the decline of Safir and the rise of Ahmed's Haseki Sultan wife, Koshem, whom he married in 1605 at the age of 15. To cement her authority, this is being Koshem, she arranged for the marriages of many imperial princesses to important officials such as Vizier Nashun Pasha. And what this means is that within the harem, even though the imperial princes were the daughters of the Sultan wasn't responsible for the arrangement of the marriages of princesses. Instead, that was the responsibility of the Sultan's wife. So this was a particular loophole, which Haseki Sultan Koshem in particular very much exploited for the next 40 years. So her daughters could act as political agents and influences on various high-profile men, including grand viziers. Koshem, perhaps more than any other figure, is responsible for ending the practice of fratricidal succession and effecting a revolution in the House of Osman. It was not expected that her son, Murad, as a younger son of Ahmed, would succeed, rather than attempting the murder of Osman's son, son of a rival Mahfiruz, she instead advocated for the succession of Mustafa, Ahmed's brother, believing that doing so would not only save her son's life, but would establish Murad as Osman's successor. So what I mean there is essentially that it wasn't intended that because she wasn't the first consort, she was the preferred consort, but she wasn't the first consort of Ahmed. Ahmed had a son by a previous relationship with the concubine, Osman. So by the idea of primogeniture, had the Ottoman system evolved into primogeniture, Osman would have succeeded and then killed off all potential rivals to the throne. Now, what Koshem is doing here is that she is pushing for this idea of brotherly succession, agnatic succession, on the basis that rather than her son being executed, this being Murad, Murad would essentially enter into the possible ranks of succession as a result of this. So even though he would only be third in line as a result of her cunning, it actually proved to be a very prudent political measure in the long term. And of course, this would have major implications for the succession system of the Ottoman Empire. Koshem at this point controlled the Grand Vizier and allied with the Aga, essentially the head or the commander of the Janissaries, to expel Mafalos from Topkapi. And again, Mafalos is her principal rival as the mother of Osman. Exerting influence over, and again, this is another sort of remarkable aspect of leverage, is that rather than eliminate Osman, she uses the expulsion of Osman's mother, who would later become very briefly the Valid Sultan, the queen mother, to bring her into, to bring the young would-be Sultan Osman into her sphere of influence. So essentially, she presented herself almost as an adopted mother. And of course, if you know Chinese history, you'll know that the Empress Dowager Xi Qi used a very similar system of adopting various princes and becoming their advocate or protector, at least nominally. And in this case with Osman, she was essentially responsible for taking him out of the palace. She would often sit in a carriage behind a veil, not being able to be seen from public as a result of this idea of the Ottoman seclusion of women and the sacredness of the internal space. But in this case, she was publicly being seen as allying with Osman, not attempting to kill him. Nevertheless, her husband, Ahmed the Sultan, didn't trust her actions and believed that there was possible hostile intent. And so, and again, this was obviously presaged with what happened with Roxana and the killing of Mustafa. So Koshem was essentially isolated from Osman to prevent what could possibly legitimately be seen as an attempt to curry favor with him, order to get close with the her political rival, and again a barrier for her own son becoming Sultan and then poisoning him. As Ahmed matured, it became apparent that he intended to rule without her support, and not under her supervision either, and Koshem was forced to retreat from government rather than be the cause of her own exile. Essentially, she was forced by Ahmed, who was very much intent at this early age of becoming Sultan, that if you overstep your mark, if you intend to exert your influence over the government, I will simply banish you. And in that case, not only would that mean her own loss of political power, but it would possibly condemn her son's life as well, if her husband decided to champion the succession of Osman against Murad. And I think what is remarkable is that Ahmed then very quickly dies. This is a system of a lot of the Ottoman sultans we see, is that they often die. In this case, Ahmed died at the age of 27. And essentially, Koshem's plan worked. She had positioned herself as the guardian of not just her son, but of all the princes. And when her husband, Ahmed, died, she began to champion the succession of his mentally enfeebled brother, Mustafa. And in terms of rationalizing this, rather than having a system whereby the Ottoman Sultan, his son, becomes ruler, kills off all the other brothers, this is reorientating the system towards this idea of agnatic seniority, whereby it is the eldest member of the House of Osman who succeeds, rather than the son of a previous Sultan. And of course, with the exception, with the expectation, therefore, that because this is based on seniority, that her own son, Koshem's own son, Murad, had now guaranteed a place in the succession, which would have been denied to him had a fratricide been able to take place. What made this all the more extraordinary, this transition towards agnatic seniority, was that Mustafa, the brother of Ahmed, was deemed unfit to rule and placed under the regency of his mother Halime. And again, this is the same Halime who had just been censured some two decades earlier by Safiya. And again, this is really the first time we see the direct regencies of very many women throughout the 17th century. So rather than, again, the agnatic seniority is basically a Trojan horse, which deepens the sultanate of women. It doesn't increase the power of the sultan. The sultan now was no more than the puppet of a various clique, a court faction. And because this was essentially a novel situation, the novelty of the situation was still fresh, and the contrivance of various eunuchs, in particular the chief white eunuch and black eunuch, court women and janissaries, Mustafa was quickly deposed by another court faction and replaced by Ahmed's firstborn, Osman II, which had the Ottoman Empire maintained a system of primogeniture, would have become the sultan. The influence of court women, however, was so profound by this point that when the sultan's mother died, so this would have been Mahfuz, a new queen mother, Valid Sultan, was appointed for him, his own governess. So the idea was now so ridiculous that the role of the queen mother was so essential to maintaining the power of the sultan that when a sultan's mother died, Osman II had to contrive the creation of a new queen mother to be his court advocate within the imperial harem. And in this case, Osman II really is a tragic figure in that despite the fact he was only a teenager when he attempted to rescue himself and the sultanate from this humiliating position, he was able, again, he was probably one of the first sultans to actually begin conducting successful military campaigns. In this particular instance, he immediately went on campaign against Poland after the death of his mother, the Valid Sultan Halime. And when he failed to take one particular fortress, so this would have been the fortress of Choshim, Hyokim, he blamed this on the degeneracy of the Janissaries. He essentially believed that the Janissaries could not be relied on to fulfill their job, which was engaging in expansion campaigns and in siege warfare. So the Janissaries needed to be reformed, and Osman II embarked on a major series of military reforms, which also centered on reconciling the grievances with the Sepkans, the Kelali rebels in Anatolia. The Janissaries, meanwhile, were to have their pay deducted and their coffee shops closed. And again, Sufism has this particular association with the coffee shops. And for his efforts, Osman II was deposed in a Janissary-led coup d'etat and murdered. And his ear, and again, when you murder a sultan, you often do it by a ritual strangulation. And his ear was presented to the mother of Mustafa Sultan, the deposed sultan, an indication that her son would be restored. And this marks the first time that the sultan was murdered by the Janissaries. And this again can be attributed due to his lack of a Valid Sultan, indeed Osman's need for a surrogate. And when looking at the idea that Kusham had originally cultivated a relationship with Osman II, it sort of betrays the fact that, you know, Koshem was prepared to suck up to Osman when he was the sultan, but her ultimate preference would have been for her own children, in this case Murad. So Osman was left without an effective advocate in the true center of power, the imperial harem. Rather than reward the regicides, Mustafa, under the influence of his own mother and Kara Pasha, executed the rebels. And then, of course, Mustafa spent his brief restoration. Mustafa, by now, was considered by all sort of sources to be completely insane. Spent his brief year-long restoration running around the Topkapi Palace, opening various cupboards, expecting to find the now dead Osman II hiding from him and jumping out at any moment, expecting to depose him. Conflict was now brewing between the Sefahis, these were the elite cavalry corps of the Ottoman Empire, and the Janissaries for influence and land, while an Ottoman official led a rebellion against Mustafa, resulting in the Sultan's second deposition. To elaborate further on what I mean by this revolution of the House of Osman, deposed sultans and rebellious brothers were killed less frequently. Instead, the imperial harem was now host to the kafes, or cage, and I've got an image here of the cage adjoining the imperial harem. And this is a form of essentially gilded seclusion, a gilded prison. Mustafa in particular was kept in seclusion until his death in 1639, having reigned twice, albeit briefly. Progressively from, and again, in terms of relaying this back to the system of succession as a whole and the liberty of the various princes, when we go all the way back to Osman, the founder of the dynasty, Orhan, his eventual heir, because again, he was only Osman Bey, he wasn't Sultan at this point, Orhan was essentially considered his joint ruler. And what the Ottomans do very early, unlike the, say, for example, the French system of feudalism, is that the sons aren't awarded patrimonies. There is no appanage system such as like the French and the Dukes of Burgundy, creating potential sources of rivalry to the collateral branches of the ruling family to the king himself. No, in this case, the sultans very early on returned and centralized all patrimonies, and would instead dole out various governorships to each of the sons. And then again, with the idea of the son having to acquire prestige, this establishes the idea of fratricidal succession, the elimination of all members, not just of all brothers of the sultan, but all of all collateral branches of the family as well. So from this time, so we're talking the reign of Murad all the way up until Suleiman the Magnificent, the sultan's immediate family was the House of Osman, with the Sultan's immediacy cementing his individual power at the height of the empire. Now I want to turn briefly back to that book by Pierce. In the second half of the 16th century, a series of changes occurred that had the result, within three generations, of completely divesting princes of power through oppression of their political and sexual maturity. Murad III was the last Sultan to dispatch his son to a provincial governorate. Henceforth, princes would not leave the imperial palace, nor would they be allowed to father children unless and until they became sultan. Between the public celebration of a circumcision, and again, this is a practice all sort of beginning with Ottoman sultans, it's not just Jewish, but also Islamic, and the public celebration of his enthronement, a prince disappeared behind the harem walls, deprived of the identity that came from possession of a piece of the patrimony and the production of heirs. A prince no longer headed a household and therefore lacked, in both real and symbolic terms, the most important foundation of a political career. The transformation of the role of princes was an intrinsic aspect of the changes in the system of succession. During the three generations during which princes went from being well-known public figures to virtual unknowns, the Ottoman dynasty moved from a system of seniority when Ahmed I, the first sultan, not to have served as princely governor, died in 1617. He was succeeded by his brother, Mustafa, as I mentioned earlier. This was the first time in the 14 generations of the Ottoman rule that a sultan was not followed by one of his sons. A necessary aspect of this idea of seniority as the principle of succession was the restoration of the rightful claim to sovereignty of the collateral dynastic lines. The practice of fratricide lapsed, and now the greatest fear of a male dynast was that he might not live long enough to take his turn on the throne. In the 22 generations of the Ottoman dynasty that followed, Ahmed I, the throne always passed to the eldest living male Ottoman, and only three times did a son succeed his father. For the most part, sultans were followed by their brothers, less frequently by nephews, and once by a cousin. While one could argue that these changes constituted a radical break with most of the Ottoman past, one could argue that they did not undermine certain fundamental principles of Ottoman political culture. It is probably for this reason that these seemingly revolutionary developments provoke little comment or comment in contemporary histories. Certainly, they upheld the principle that all male members of the dynasty deserved a chance at governing. Indeed, strict limitation of the succession to a son of the previous ruler was unusual, not only in the states influenced by Central Asian Turco-Mongol tradition, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, but also in pre-Mongol Muslim states not influenced by that tradition. In some of these states, succession passed from father to son only in the first generations, suggesting that this pattern may be associated with the consolidation of a new state. It is no coincidence that a prolonged father-son pattern of succession was not unique to the Ottomans, but was characteristic of the more stable and long-lasting states of the post-Mongol period. Notably, in addition to the Ottomans, we're talking about the Safavids and the Qajars in Iran. And again, the Qajari dynasty is the dynasty which takes over Iran during the 19th century. the Mughals in India, and of course, this is the dynasty founded by Babur in the year 1526 and continues under Akbar the Great and continues to rule most of India throughout the 17th century. And if we expand the notion of son to include the fictive filiation in Mamluks in Egypt, and again, this idea essentially of, the slave dynasties, the idea that you're adopting a slave to become your heir, and this was again an assumption implicit in the idea of being a Janissary. However, the Ottoman transition to seniority midway through the empire's history in no way resembled the disorganized succession characteristic of the dissolution of pre-Mongol Muslim states. The practice of seniority in the Ottoman state preserved what was the most enduring feature of Ottoman politics, absolute control of the dynasty, if not by the individual sultan. But ultimately, the dynasty as the nexus and legitimate source of the distribution of power. So, what I mean by a revolution of the House of Osman is the sultan is disempowered, but the dynasty remains. And this sort of perfectly again assumes the idea of agnatic seniority. Rather than have a small family revolving around the person of the emperor, the sultan, the padishah, and his concubines. Instead, now you have possibly dozens, hundreds of collateral branches of the House of Osman, and this is a system which continues today. And of course, if you want to give yourself a headache, look at the modern system of Ottoman succession, how complicated it is to maintain this idea that it is the eldest member of the family who controls the household and not this rather straightforward idea of primogeniture, which was established in the West. With the deposition of Mustafa for a second time, Kusham's son, Murad IV, became Sultan in 1623. Murad was only 11 at this point, meaning that Kushem was his regent in addition to being Velid Sultan for the next 9 years. She ran meetings of the Divan, the cabinet, from behind the veil, direct political appointments, and even she was responsible for direct political appointments and even met foreign ambassadors in person, breaking many traditions of this idea of the sanctity of the inner space. Letters were addressed not to the Sultan, but to Kushem, who had effectively supplanted their son, rather than pretending to assume only a nominal rule under him as his regent. Where she could not act directly, she acted through her puppet grand viziers, such as Hafiz Ahmed Pasha. From the outset, she had to deal with rebellions and invasions, causing the first rift between her and her son when Murad favored war with Spain. Kushem's policy over the previous decades of arranged marriages had clearly borne fruit, as key military officials, such as the Admiral Rekab Pasha and the Governor of Egypt, followed their wives, who in turn followed their mother, the Queen Mother. Kushem was fully aware of this from a point of view of pure political utility, and her daughters would not only be married but remarried. And from her correspondence, we know that she would curry favor during her regency by sending out her daughters to marry potential allies. And this is a brief quotation from a letter to Hafiz Ahmed Pasha. "Whenever you're ready, let me know, and I'll act accordingly. We'll take care of you right away. I have a princess ready. I'll do just as I'll do when I sent out my dear Fatima." And of course, that was another daughter of Kushem Sultan. And here, in this particular passage, Kushem is referring to Aisha, who Kushem was responsible for marrying off 6 times during her 40 years in power. Nevertheless, Kushem's authority was not absolute. Murad was in a state of constant ill health, and so the foundation of her authority was weak, should Murad had died prematurely. And so essentially, this was all about the nature of her own political survival as a regent, because of course, as a woman, you don't rule in your own right, especially in the Ottoman context. You're only ruling as a pretext for someone else. So even if you are the Velid Sultan and you're living in a system which is dominated by women and dominated by the imperial harem, maintaining a son through which you could rule, at least nominally, was essential. And of course, being a woman and also nominally having to act from the imperial harem in the state of seclusion meant she couldn't campaign directly. Such a thing was out of the question. Often, as is the case in these early modern societies such as Elizabeth, when you have a woman ruling, you would have to rely on a sword. In the case of Elizabeth, we're talking about someone like the Earl of Leicester. In the case of Kushem, this was a particular effective figure who become a large part of the later conquest of Crete, Hussein Pasha. and cleverly one of Murad's first intrigues against the over sort of bearing power of his mother is to attempt to actively interfere in his mother's policy of political marriages and prevent his mother marrying off one of his sisters to Hussein Pasha, thereby creating the split between the sword of the Queen Mother and herself. Kushem could do little to attempt to distract her son in these various political intrigues, other than by bestowing him various gifts and banquets. And of course, as I'm about to elaborate with the character Murad IV, you understand why he didn't take very kindly to this. A palace revolt led by the Janissaries in 1632 resulted in the death of Hafiz Ahmad Pasha and provided the pretext to Murad to ultimately remove his mother. It was a much needed pretext. While Murad was convinced that a strong policy against the Janissaries was needed to prevent him meeting the same fate as his brother Osman II. Kushem was relegated to a deputy ruler, directing the Sultan's rule only in Constantinople, only in his absence. The threat of his expulsion now loomed over her, should she, Kushem, overstep her authority. Between the years 1632 and 1640, Murad IV's reign was absolute, a clear anomaly of the 17th century. Upon reaching his majority, Murad was not only intent on ruling, but on remedying the decay and corruption since the late reign of Suleiman. Many contemporaries believed this represented a new Selim the Grim. In addition to banning alcohol, tobacco and coffee in Constantinople, the Sultan would often wander the streets in civilian clothes, lurking around lowly taverns, and when he would see someone breaking these various prohibitions, he would remove his clothes, i.e. to reveal his official insignia, and he would directly behead offenders personally on the spot. And this was often done for minor infractions. Execution was typically the punishment now for breaking any of these prohibitions. So it wasn't just that the Sultan was going out and personally enforcing these executions, but the overall punishments for these breaking these prohibitions became far stricter. The Sultan's bloodlust ranged ultimately on the psychopathic, as his executions went beyond official punishments to shooting boat passengers with a bow and arrow every time they approached too closely to his sacred compound of the Topkapi Palace. In foreign affairs, Murad was equally ambitious, prosecuting new campaigns against the Persians, conquering Azerbaijan, and reversing many of the gains made under Shah Abbas the Persian, including an interruption to Ottoman rule in Mesopotamia. By that I mean Shah Abbas interrupting Ottoman rule in Mesopotamia. And under Murad IV is able to reconquer Mesopotamia, capture Baghdad, and through the port of Basra, he is cementing his contact with the Mughals, solidifying that alliance. And if you look at this, if I get a map, I probably actually won't be able to show it. To the east, of course, you have the Ottomans, east of Iraq, east of Anatolia, and further to the east, around the Kandahar region, you have the furthest extent of the Mughal Sultanate. So the idea of Murad IV was to conquer Iran from the east and from the west in a joint Ottoman Mughal campaign. But of course, like many of his predecessors, he would die prematurely before he could see this sort of success. And to make matters worse for Murad, and this is a remarkable instance in Ottoman history where the whole dynasty could have been wiped out. Yes, John, not real name. I mean Kandahar. The Mughals began their dynasty in Kabul. And the Kandahar region was essentially the battleground between the Safavid Iranians and the Mughal dynasty. When it came to Murad IV, he had one court consort, Aisha Sultan, and all of their sons predeceased the Sultan. And he died at the age of 27 from liver infection. It would have been quite ironic if that was as a result of over-drinking, but I very much doubt it. And this leaves the remarkable situation where his brother Ibrahim, known as Ibrahim the Mad, was now the sole heir to the House of Osman, despite all of these attempts to establish a broader network of imperial princes through this idea of agnatic seniority or collateral succession. And this was because Murad had already executed his younger brothers, and ostensibly his dying wish was to execute his brother Ibrahim. Better that the Ottoman dynasty come to an end rather than let the empire be ruled by a madman. Koshem interceded to spare her son, and thus, in sparing Ibrahim from the last act of the last order of Murad IV, she saved the dynasty. But more importantly, again, she was now regent. Koshem's hold over now the Sultan Ibrahim was originally sustained through her ready procurement of concubines for him, indulging his every sexual obsession. In particular, the Sultan was obsessed by very large women. In fairness to Koshem, this also resolved the crisis of the dynasty by producing a steady supply of heirs, and in this respect, the dynasty was now secure. But her authority over Ibrahim was not total. Rather, she found herself competing with a witch doctor, Cinshihosha, whose influence was such that he induced the Sultan to execute a grand vizier. The irony was, of course, that Koshem had enlisted the services of Hosha to cure her son's insanity, only for him to become the Sultan's principal advisor, a position that made him incredibly rich through bribes and, again, that point of access to the imperial harem. Essentially, Hosha is possibly the closest thing you have to a Turkish Rasputin, that and the fact that his mother deliberately enlisted him to cure a seemingly incurable illness. In the case of Ibrahim, it was his madness. In the case of Rasputin, it was the haemophilia of the Tsarevich Alexis. The Sultan Ibrahim then turned his attention to a 330-pound Armenian woman whom Ibrahim called Sekapari, or my sweet lump of sugar, who exercised such influence over the Sultan that Koshem was forced to remove her by murder or exile. The sources vary and we don't have a definitive answer. Towards the end of his reign, like an Ottoman Caligula, Ibrahim made his sisters, Aisha, Fatima, and Hanzada, his concubines. It was resolved that the Sultan now had to die. Of this, everyone was agreed, apart from Koshem, who demurred. On the one hand, she wished to retain her influence. On the other hand, Ibrahim was such a liability that his continued extravagances could have precipitated another Janissary coup, if not a general revolt against the dynasty. Moreover, she was concerned about the wavering loyalties of the Grand Vizier, nor did she want to set the precedent of nobles revolting against her own progeny and undermining the dynasty. It was to this end that Koshem reluctantly consented to her son Ibrahim's strangulation in 1648, on the assumption that this coup would be localized to Ibrahim and that she would simply transfer her control over to her grandson, Mehmet IV, who was only seven. Given that the expectation was that Mehmed IV's own mother, Turhan, would have now become the Valid Sultan, Koshem now outflanked Turhan, making herself Buyuk Valid Sultan, the Grand Dowager Queen, and inaugurated a third regency. And again, corresponding to this, we see, you can say, the complete sort of collapse of the Ottoman authority throughout the provinces. We see uprisings in Anatolia. The Ottomans are engaging in what seems like a futile attempt to take the Isle of Crete since 1645. And worse, the Ottomans are defeated in battle, a naval battle, by the Venetians near the Dardanelles Straits at the Battle of Phocis. The treasury was now empty. And to pay the Janissaries, Koshem essentially ordered that the merchants were forced to hand over real money, silver currency, in return for fake debased currency. And in response, 20,000 artisans and merchants revolted against Koshem, and the Janissaries, who had now been paid due to this extortion, brutally put down the revolt. It was at this point that Turhan attempted to depose Koshem. Allied with the eunuchs and the vizier, Koshem's authority was reliant on the Janissaries. To resolve this feud, Turhan, Koshem resolved to depose Mehmet IV and replace him with his brother Suleiman. A coup, and again, this is remarkable, and it shows you the extent of this idea of the Sultanate of Women. This is not a coup by a sultan or a contender aimed at another sultan. This is a coup initiated by the Grand Dowager Queen against another Dowager Queen in order to get another Dowager Queen who is more pliant to the Grand Dowager Queen in power. Just to indicate how irrelevant the Ottoman sultans had become at this point, and how Mehmet IV and his brother Suleiman, who had briefly become Suleiman II in the 1680s, were all assumed to be nothing more than puppets as part of these grand palace intrigues. However, I think this is Koshem's last military gambit, this idea to depose Mehmet IV and get around Turhan Sultan from her rightful place as Valid Sultan. Because this idea of a coup, which would have again removed one sultan and replaced Mehmet IV with Suleiman, was betrayed. Her plans, Koshem's plans, were betrayed, and she was assassinated by Turhan's agents. And after, this is quite a tragic story, after several failed attempts at killing the queen, bashing her on the head, she lost consciousness at one point. She was richly strangled, but managed to get up again. The queen grandmother, Koshem, was finally strangled with her own hair. And in the ensuing palace coup, this is in 1653, some 2,000 people were killed. So again, another incredibly bloody event in the history of Ottoman court politics. Now, coming back to, so we've seen the demise of Koshem Sultan, who had essentially run the Ottoman Empire at various points with various levels of authority for the last 45 years. And with Turhan Sultan, the mother of Mehmet IV, she is the last sort of great figure in terms of this period known as the Sultanate of Women. And she is less known for her direct political intrigues than through the inauguration, her role in the inauguration of the Koprulu era, the last period of Ottoman recovery and growth before the disaster of the Siege of Vienna and the Great Turkish War. And this, of course, was the Koprulu essentially rose to power on the back of this major crisis resulting from the disastrous reign of Ibrahim. And you could say the mismanagement of Koshem and her over-reliance on the Janissaries, because the government was bankrupt. The Venetians were prosecuting a war in Crete. All of this needed to be resolved. And essentially to save the dynasty, Turhan selected one member of this Koprulu family, Mehmet Pasha, as Grand Vizier in 1656. And what is remarkable, rather than simply relying on the Grand Vizier as another pawn, what Turhan does in opposition to predecessor Koshem is give him essentially absolute discretion, carte blanche, to run the empire as he would so wish, on the assumption that he could turn the fortunes of the Ottoman Empire around. And he's successful. The reforms of the Koprulu dynasty enabled the empire to break the Venetian blockade. And there was also a rebellion going on in one of the empire's vassals, Transylvania, and they are brought to heel. The rebellions in Anatolia cease, and these often met by the Koprulu family often hand out the most sort of draconian punishments against unruly soldiers and officers and their various military purges and massacres during this time. And of course, this in turn causes another revolt within the army. But this is quickly repressed. And what this does is not only prove the capabilities of the Koprulu family, but it ensures their political their political supremacy, not just over the governorship, the stewardship of a single Grand Vizier, but over three over the next 30 years. The first Koprulu Pasha is succeeded in 1661 by Fazil Ahmad Pasha. He continues the tradition of reforms and begins, you can say, the first sort of major phase of expansion against the Ottoman the Ottoman Empire's enemies. So he wages war against the Habsburgs in 1663. He annexes Crete in 1669 and begins to expand actively in the Podolia region in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And this policy is continued even more with Kara Mustafa Pasha, who is known as the great defeated party during the Siege of Vienna. And again, he will ultimately be subject to ritual strangulation for his failure in this regard. However, we're not just talking about military reforms and political reforms initiated under this, these generalissimos of the Ottoman dynasty, because this also coincides with, we saw with Murad IV, we saw a period of great reaction against what was considered rightly possible, the degeneracy of not only the Ottoman court, but Ottoman society at large. So during the reign of Mehmet IV, the Koprulu enlist the services of the Kadizedi religious movement in Istanbul, led by Vani Mehmet Efendi, who was made the official court preacher for Sultan Mehmet IV. And he plays a major role in shaping the religious policy of the empire, based on the idea of enjoining good and forbidding wrong, that all believers have to enforce religious orthodoxy and combat innovation or heresy. And to this end, you could say Orthodox Sunnism was very much prioritized against Sufism. And of course, knowing that particular association between the Janissaries and Sufism, this was also a roundabout way of undermining the authorities of the Janissaries. Now, this group was very successful in that essentially it put the empire back on a reactionary course. However, it did irritate many of the contemporary Islamic theologians of the time, such as Katib Celebi and Mustafa Naima. And this religious revival, supported by the Sultan, was only possible so long as the Kapruli family was successful. So when we see the decline of the Kapruli dynasty and the failure, the military failure at Vienna, which will be the subject for a future episode, the great humbling of the Ottoman Empire, and the great reversal of their fortunes, and you can say the relegation of the Ottoman Empire from a major power, a first-rate power, to a second-rate power. This will be the subject of a future episode. So while the period of the extreme influence from the Hesseki and the Vlid Sultans was now coming to a close, and Turhan, by the way, would die the same year as the Siege of Vienna, the era of the absolute Sultan as Ghazi, as military leader, as a campaigning warlord was over, and the nature of Ottoman rule had irrevocably changed. The changes ushered in a revolution of the House of Osman, and this would persist until the end of the empire in the 20th century. And if you count the succession system, the Ottoman pretenders still use this idea of agnatic seniority to this day. So it really is a profound change, midway through the history of the empire, and even the system of seclusion. It may seem absurd to us, but the brothers of Abdul Hamid II, so we're talking the late 19th century, were still kept in seclusion in the imperial harem right up until the end of the empire. So the system persevered, even though the empire was being various experiments with constitutionalism, the Tanzimat reforms, etc. The imperial harem retained its primacy as a as essentially the main sort of arena of imperial power, and the Janissaries, of course, would persist all the way up until as a major political force up until the early 19th century as well. So that is it for the lecture. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll quickly go over super chats, and if you want to answer any questions, then please do so. The Duchy for £8.99. Thank you for your wonderful insights. Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll just go over. So please do, before I go, because there are no other super chats, go over and ask your questions of me quickly before I run off. Perhaps stability of empire, cheating, turbulence, and instability at the top, only calming with external crisis. Yes, I mean, it didn't help that there were external crises and internal crises at the same time. I mean, most of this was as a result of the expansion of the empire, but also this transition from expansion to maintenance. So in the case of the war with Venice, that wasn't a crisis which Cushem had nothing to do with. Rather, she had helped facilitate that crisis by using the attack on Crete as a distraction away from her son Ibrahim's rampant degeneracy. So in this case, the turbulence and instability at the top was responsible for precipitating an external crisis. So there you are. And that is so often the case. Now, regarding the siege of Candia, I'm not a military historian, John, not real name. Other than that being the, I would say the, when you say the Siege of Candia, this of course is the ultimate sort of takeover of Crete as a siege. In terms of the Siege of Crete, it lasted something remarkable, like 21 years. And what really marks out the success of the Capuli dynasty is they're able to finally take Crete, having belonged to the Venetians for, really, we're talking 600 years at this point. It was remarkable that the Venetians held on to it for so long, a Venetian island in the middle of the Eastern Mediterranean. But nevertheless, despite the praise I'm giving the Capuli dynasty for resolving many of the empire's problems, not only resolving the internal issues and modernizing the army and beginning a conservative religious reform of the empire to counteract the rampant degeneracy of the empire, and of course of the Janissaries, the Capuli family still took what 13 years to take over Crete. So even as part of this ongoing effort to take back the island, and I believe the Cretans were very much outnumbered. I think it was something like 100,000 soldiers and Ottoman soldiers versus 20,000 Cretans and their Venetian allies, Venetian citizens, and yes, an absolutely horrific war, which is the most important sort of military engagement throughout this period. Did the Ottomans ever reach the Caspian Sea? I vaguely remember them winning a war with the Safavids and gaining control of the Caucasus. Yes, under the reign of Murad III. I don't have a map here, but if you look at this map I have here, just imagine the northern eastern part of Anatolia, so the northeastern part of this map, extending across to Azerbaijan and linking to the Caspian Sea. However, it should be noted that the Ottomans regularly reached Tabriz and they regularly reached the Caspian. The difference is that they never were able to hold on to this region effectively. And what we see with the campaigns of Murad IV or Shah Abbas or Murad III is that they are always returning in various peace deals to the status quo of 1555, established by Suleiman the Magnificent, which forms the modern borders of eastern Anatolia and Mesopotamia then, but is now Iraq with Iran. And of course, this isn't taking into account, ethnic differentiations or even religious differentiations. There are many Shias in this area of Mesopotamia, and of course, the Safavid dynasty was a Shia dynasty. And in terms of the ethnic disposition, temper of these regions, a large part of eastern Anatolia was Armenian, so was a large part of the Safavid Caucasus, and there were Arabs, Mashriqi Arabs, Iraqis in the Khuzestan region east of Basra. Polish ambassador, I heard somewhere that due to heavy harem breeding, later sultans were almost half Slavic. Is it scientifically true? Are the Slavic really the most beautiful people? I'm not sure of. I'm not, again, that's. I don't want to get into points about the philosophy of beauty. That's really not relevant to the stream. But in terms of the Ottoman preference for it, yes, there is a overwhelming representation of Slavic women. Kushem was not Slavic; she was Greek. But many of the Ottoman sultanas were Greek. In fact, if you want a complete breakdown of the ethnic of the ethnicity of the Velid sultans, there is an article in the description which goes over this in depth. So I'd recommend you checking that out. I can't quite remember which one it is, but it's the one referring to the harem politics. So there you are. It's one of the set reading for the discussion on Monday. Why was it a horrific war? Except the point it took 21 years. The military frontier, what did it entail? Where were their families? Was it barren? I don't know enough about it, I'm afraid. John, not real name, other than the list of casualties and other various relief efforts. I don't know in terms of, I mean, the attack on Rhodes was equally grueling, and as was the case with Malta and Rhodes, when you're conducting a military campaign with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of soldiers, most of those soldiers are going to die of disease. And this is taking place in the so-called general crisis of the 17th century. So disease and armies and movements of armies is commonplace. So most of these soldiers are dying of disease. And I think it is this, the use of so many soldiers combined with the longevity of the conflict, which makes it so horrific. It seems there are always eras in the context of an empire where women rule. What leads to this? Well, in the case of the Ottoman Empire, it was frankly degeneracy on the part of the sultans. Mehmed the sorry, Selim the Second, very much began his rule with the intent to be dominated by his sister and his wife and Nohanu. And to leave the court affairs, the running of the empire in the hands of his Vlad Sultan, while he would enjoy the pleasures of the harem. So, and I mean that in the broader sense. I don't mean that simply in the sexual sense. Hopefully, by going over the nature of the harem in this lecture, we've dispelled this association of the harem as synonymous with brothel. Really, the idea of that in Islamic circles is rather ridiculous. But all, obviously, there was some truth to it if you take into account the reign, in particular, of Ibrahim between 1640 and 1614, which I think is a nadir in terms of the moral degeneracy of the dynasty, which didn't help the women who were trying to rule the empire in the stead, in particular, Kosham. Right, I think. I dislike the reasons they abandoned the Christian faith and did not bother converting or trying to convert their husbands. Well, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that there would be more advocacy, because one aspect of the Sultanate of Women, which I haven't gone over, because it's rather obvious and it's been sort of covered in previous lectures, especially when I went over Hürrem Sultan. But they engaged in a lot of charitable activities. But there was no evidence, really, especially with Hürrem Sultan, that the charitable activities disproportionately favoured Christians. So there was no sort of in-group preference or really an attempt by someone, a Greek Christian like Kushan Sultan, to really change the fundamental nature of the empire. And really, I think you can say that it's a testament to the effective system of grooming these women, training these women to become effective empresses, giving them the education of sultans, and immersing them in the history of the Ottoman Empire and the theology of Islam, which they were in all likelihood far more familiar with than their own Christian upbringing. It should be noted that these slave girls were brought in very young. They would enter into the imperial court, in early adolescence, even if not before that, and they would be expected to marry the sultan when, for example, in the case of Kushab Sultan, she was 16, but in some cases you were married even younger. So the idea that these various slave women had very strongly sort of held convictions, and they weren't, in many ways, they were a product of the system. They weren't outsiders necessarily trying to change the system from within. Right, I think that's it in terms of the questions I'm willing to answer for this evening. All I have to say, really, in terms of what's next for the channel, is that please do tune in for the discussion on Monday, and we'll have Semigog and Columba, as far as I'm aware, on that. I only think it's appropriate on Valentine's Day that we discuss the Sultanate of Women. So there you are. Thank you all very much for listening, and good night.